I would try to be better at inside looking out than outside looking in.
John, I want to thank you so much.
Are we rolling?
For being on this podcast. I mean, you know, you're one of the few guys that when I first talked to you 3 years ago when I started, I came to you and I said, John, and I've been knowing you for 30 years now.
At least.
And I used to when you had your GTR, you said, let's drive it. I said, no, John, I don't want to drive. No, the reason why I drive it, because that thing, I knew how powerful it was. But you said, let's come, go ahead, trying to push me to drive your GTR because you were so happy with it. And I said, that's okay. And what'd you get next after that? Because you've always had something nice.
I like cars.
You do?
Yeah. The GTR was is a great automobile.
It still
because
is.
Because it's all-wheel drive.
Yes, I know.
So a lot of these high-end performance cars, you have to really learn how to drive them when you go into a circuit, mm-hmm. and especially around the corner.
Did you do that?
I went to Suzuka. Carlos Ghosn was a friend of the family. I have a lot of time for him. Whatever you can say, a lot of time for him and his family.
Carlos Ghosn's youngest daughter was my son's girlfriend.
Miles' girlfriend, Nadine.
The oldest.
Nadine was Miles' girlfriend.
Okay, so we...
Anyway.
This is beautiful.
So when Carlos, of course, got 01, I got the second one off the production line without the limiter. And I can say that now because it's highly
illegal. Right, of course, yeah. So that's why you wanted me to, okay.
And you can't drive it without a limiter in Tokyo, okay. Obviously, you know. But yeah. If you go to the circuit, they will let you drive it. I did go to racing school, actually, in California.
Okay.
But thanks for that. It was a great car.
Yeah, it was nice. Where were you born, John?
Kobe, Japan.
Kobe? You born in Kobe?
Yeah.
I know that. Yeah. Born and raised, and you stayed
through high
there.
School. Yeah.
Through high school.
Yeah. So but I went to
Canadian. But you have a family Academy. History there, though, don't you?
Well, the headlines is I was born in Kobe.
Okay.
Went to Canadian Academy, which is a bit of a misnomer. It was started by Canadian missionaries in 1913. I think it's the oldest school in Western Japan. It's called Canadian Academy, but it's like your Nishimachi, mixed kids, half Japanese, half foreign. A lot of missionary kids when I was a kid, because just the way it was, they had a dormitory, so the kids' parents could send them there.
Right.
My mom went to CA, you know, before the war. I have cousins who went there. On my mother's side, and my cousin's kids, so I think there are 8 of us who went through CA.
So is your mother's side of the family that really has the history here?
Yeah. My dad came in 52.
Okay. The year I was born.
The year you were born.
That's right.
Year.
My goodness. Tell me about it. So, okay, so what was it like growing up here? And then, so you learned to speak Japanese, and did you
that,
learn
that,
the culture?
Actually, that is a very relevant question, Lance, because my grandparents, who are buried in Kobe, were political refugees from Russia. So 1917 revolution, they had to get out because they were white Russians. They would have been prosecuted and probably killed. So they ended up in Japan. And one of the reasons that I speak Japanese as well as I do is I spoke only Japanese until I went to first grade. And it was a conscious effort by my mother who, you know, when you come to a country with nothing and you can say, all right, how do we put food on the table? She figured if I spoke fluent Japanese, I could always put food on the table.
But you're not the only child, are you?
I am the only child. My parents are much older. My dad was 47, mom was 36 when I was born.
Okay.
So, you know, it's the last, pop's last go. Yeah. But, so the short answer is that the reason it's called a mother tongue is because it's the language your mother speaks to. And unlike Tokyo, Kobe is much more parochial. Television, when we were kids, it was all dubbed. Foreign programs like the FBI and Star Trek and all that was dubbed into Japanese.
Right.
So, you know, obviously you thought all foreigners spoke Japanese because they spoke that on television. TV was limited to either Japanese TV or these kind of dub shows. The housekeepers were Japanese, not Thai or Filipinos like you had in Tokyo.
Because that was the time when you had housekeepers.
You had housekeepers.
That's right, because everything was cheap here. It was $4. You grew up through all of it, yeah. I came here at $3.60 to the dollar.
Right.
But you know, 410, 520.
No. It was pegged to 360 after the war.
Was it?
Yeah.
It was 360 after the
Brentwood's agreement. But
someone told me that
the black market may have had a
410.
Different exchange rate.
They did.
But it was kept to 360 for a very, very long time, until 1971.
Okay.
And that's when a lot of things started to change for port towns like Kobe and Yokohama, because the people who were here, particularly after the war, pre-war, Kobe was humming. You know, that's a sidebar, but when the earthquake happened in Tokyo in 23, a lot of people in Tokyo got spooked, just like 311. And folks from Yokohama, folks from Tokyo said, this is kind of spooky. We're going to move somewhere where it's safe. And Kansai never had earthquakes. So the population, foreign population of Kobe after 23, the delta was like this. Four schools, Indian social club. There were two Indian clubs. There's a German club. One of the oldest clubs in Japan is the Kobe Club, which I'm a member, and I'm very fond of that. The KREC and the YCC, these were all, you know, old institutions that were started right after Meiji as a place for foreigners to gather. So that's the Kobe story.
Wow.
Yeah. When the earthquake happened here in 23.
Right, in 23.
It was massive, and there were a lot of foreigners here already. They got spooked, and they said, let's go somewhere where it's supposed to be safe. And and Kobe being a port town and all that. So a lot of business people in Kobe were in import-export. Mm. Textiles, pearls, machinery. A lot of Germans in Kobe, as a matter of fact.
Well, trade was the biggest thing.
It was the biggest thing.
That was the biggest thing.
Kobe was the biggest port until the 95 earthquake.
Yeah.
So that first dynamic of the yen, you know, perennially getting stronger, made import-export very tough business. So the population started to dwindle a little bit. A lot of Jewish folks were there. I mean, you may have seen this movie, but there's effectively a guy who was like Schindler, who let a lot of Jews come into Kobe. So there was a very large Jewish population.
Indians,
Chinese, the Muslim. You know, the largest mosque, I believe, is still in Kobe. My grandfather started the Russian Orthodox Church in Kobe for the Russian community. It was a very large community packed into a real small area.
Right.
Essentially, Motoazu Minamiazu, Tokyo American Club.
That's Kobe right. With mountains town. Right behind it. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know my buddy Deepu Sadwani.
Yes, Deepu. Oh, go all the time.
He and I played a lot of sport at the KREC. Yeah. So it was a wonderful environment to grow up.
They were into textiles, yeah.
Yeah, no, apartment buildings.
Oh, he got that as well, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the one he lives in. I went up there just to visit with him.
Yeah, killer penthouse roof.
Tell me about it, isn't it?
The Indian community was kind of bifurcated in Kobe. You had those that were in textiles, a lot of folks in textiles, and a lot of people in precious stones.
Is that right?
And Kobe, of course, was known for its pearls for many, 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 many years, cultured pearls and Mikimoto and all that kind of stuff. Nice. So the long story short, it was a fabulous environment to grow up in. And even more so because, unlike Tokyo, you had a lot of nature.
Right.
So you have the mountains of Kobe, you can go skiing. Suma Beach was a couple miles away. And it was a small town where you could walk from one corner to another.
And you stayed there until you were what?
High school.
High school, so 17, 18?
Yeah.
And then where'd you go from there?
I went to three colleges. We'll leave them unnamed, but I played ball at San Diego, Hawaii, and University of Victoria. I played basketball. I was pretty good at basketball.
Well, they called you what, Jumping John or something?
Jumping Jack,
right?
For Japan, I was very good.
And wait, when did you get your height? How tall were you then?
I was my height in seventh grade.
Okay, so you got that in seventh grade. Really?
Seventh grade photos, everything's rolled up.
Is that right?
I'm waiting for a plug because I grew so much in 1 year.
Is that right?
But so I did play ball, but never started. And the level of basketball, Lance, I don't have to tell you. You know, you go from Japan to San Diego, and the guys are bigger and they're well trained. And
That's right.
Never started. I was first or second off the bench. Yeah, it was fun. So I was a jock.
Wow. So how long did you stay in the States?
I was in San Diego, Hawaii, and then I went to school in Victoria, British Columbia, because I was Marine Sciences and Colonial History was my major.
Why?
But I was interested in it.
Well, where did you get that interest from? Your mother or father? Because that has to start when you're young.
Marine Sciences, because I was always a water guy, too.
Okay.
And I had this passion for cloning Kazunoko kombu. I don't know if you know what
Kazunoko
that
kombu.
Is.
Kazunoko kombu, really?
Kazunoko kombu, as you know, is a delicacy here.
Okay.
And it's very expensive, the real stuff. But on Vancouver Island, particularly in an area called Nanaimo, you had the kuroshio, the black current that went around, so the waters are warm. And the university was one of the first to start cloning kelp. Kelp is a very simple organism. It's not that complicated to actually clone. And so the idea was to clone the kelp and have the Kazunoko, the herring lay their eggs on the Kazunoko, and we're going to sell it to Japan and make a bunch of money.
Well?
It worked, and then a Japanese trading company that will remain unnamed bought out the rights for it, and they took it over, and they made a business. But this is, Lance, 35, 40 years
ago.
Now
tell me something about the process of cloning. I remember Dolly the sheep, and they said they cloned it and everything else. But when you're cloning, what's the basic process that goes into cloning? Because of course, you're not taking an egg and having a sperm or something, you know, whatever.
For particularly something like kelp, which is a very simple weed, essentially, the seaweed, the cloning process, which I was not personally involved in, but that's what I wanted to learn to make the Kozunoko Kombu, is a relatively simple process, unlike cloning sheep or humans or chickens or dogs or anything like that. Think about it this way. It would be like if you had an orange tree, you would graft an orange and then stick it on another tree, and then you can make it grow into another flower or hybrid, a hibiscus.
That's what I think of, right.
So it's that, essentially.
It's very similar to that.
Yeah.
Okay, but you just take a portion. Okay. So then, with those two majors, which you graduated with, right?
Yeah.
What did you do when you got out of college?
I was selling ladies furs.
Well, that makes sense. That goes hand in hand with the two. You said ladies furs.
So you know, but go back.
In the States?
No, in Japan. So you see, so I was in Canada.
Okay.
I finished school. Long story short, my parents refused to give me any money since I was 13, so I had to work for my money. And as long as you work for your money, John, you can buy whatever you want. I bought a Honda 750, much to my parents. Oh, they were.
What year did you buy it?
I bought a 73.
Okay.
So it was the four-cylinder 750. And I come home.
Are you
riding a bike, John? I know, long hair and the helmet made it come out like that. Kobe and Japan in general was a pretty easy place for kids to earn money. You could do modeling jobs. I modeled dye underwear, shag rugs, whiskey joints, teaching English in the summertime. Very lucrative.
And wasn't it?
Lance, man, it was.
I know. The bubble, man, it was so nice.
It wasn't Berlitz where you're paid as
a
teacher.
I know. You got paid. You'd make Mitsubishi, the top manufacturers.
I'd leave after summer holiday in Japan, 2 months between teaching swimming, teaching English, and odd jobs of funky modeling jobs.
I go back.
I bought a Honda Civic.
I bought a Honda Civic. Easily.
So I sold a Honda Civic, and I'm looking at these furs that are, and I actually came up to Tokyo too to try to do this, but there's a bunch of fur stores in Japan. I'm looking at the price, and it's like $1.2 million for a lady's fur that I could get in Canada for 300,000 yen. Arbitrage, right?
Right.
Wait. What if I buy this stuff in Canada, bring it here, give it to the guy in the store, and sell it for $400,000? I'm still making 30% return.
That's right.
What I didn't realize is that these fur companies and businesses at that time, you actually had to finance the furs. So it wasn't like they would get a better deal. Long story short, at the end of my first summer, this is really funny, actually. Do you know what a muskrat is?
Yeah, of course, yes.
I was the muskrat king of Japan in 1979. And of all these furs I'd show to the dealers, no, sorry, John, you know, we're not interested. We have our own efforts, and you can't finance, you can't factor the merchandise. But the muskrat fur was not really introduced in Japan. And there was a company called Mitsuboshi Gomu, a belt company making belts for conveyor belts and stuff in Kobe that had a side business of importing furs. Looked out, met the guy, says he loves the muskrat. It got into Hanako or Anan, one of those ladies' magazines back at the time, and I made $32,000. That's a lot of cash.
Wait, when? In a month?
No, in a year.
In a year.
You see, what happens, obviously, is in the summertime, they'd buy the inventory for selling in the wintertime. They thought this would be a hit product. So they bought out the entire inventory where I got an exclusive from the dealer in Canada. And long story short, I was the muskrat. And then my dad goes, who was a banker, came to Japan in 52, Bank of America, says, John, you're going down the wrong path.
He didn't like it.
You got lucky.
Right.
Just like the Kazunoko thing, some trading company or somebody going to undercut you. You don't know jack about import-export because your environment in Kobe was like that. Why don't you go work for a bank or a brokerage firm? But dad, you know, colonial history, marine sciences, no one's going to hire me. Long story short, I got hired and spent 30 great years at Morgan Stanley, five in New York, and 25 here.
Yeah.
So it's serendipity, serendipity.
That's nice.
Hand I got dealt.
Wow. And how old were you when you retired? Did you have to leave at 65?
When I joined Morgan Stanley, the company went public in 86. Mm-hmm. When I joined in the early 80s, it was a partnership. So the deal was they set it up so that the partners, if they had a, what was called a full career, and I think Goldman and Morgan, a bunch of the Ivy League banks had that, essentially meant you had to be in the company for 30 years, depends on the company, 15 or 20 years as a managing director and age 55. So in a slot machine, you think three cherries. When you hit all those three, you are what's called a full career. And that gives you retirement benefits, a pension, an office in one of the offices if you're in the States, that kind of thing. So
did you hit it?
Yeah. So I did that, and so that was right around March 2011. Mm-hmm. My birthday's in February, so a month after my 55th birthday, as I'm retiring and moving to San Francisco, the earthquake happened, and so moved to San Francisco for a while. And I'll tell you. I was riding my bicycle, you know, kids were going to college there, I had family there from Kobe. In about a month and a half, I went, this is not good. And the worst was when you have a glass of wine at lunch.
Why was that?
It's just bored. And I like my alcohol, but it's, you know, after dark. But when I started having lunch with my buddies at some club or something like that in the city, and, you know, you have a glass of wine, you go, this is not the way to live. Fortunately, I met the founder of the company I work for now, Dimensional, which is a phenomenal enterprise, when I was at Morgan Stanley years back, and I helped him set up some business here. So he happened to have a place in the city, and we talked, and Alkair, what are you doing? Nothing. I'm really bored. So why don't you try, you know, setting up a gig in Japan? So I'm here on the rebound.
Wow.
I love it here, you know. How can you not?
What was it like for you during the bubble here? I mean, you're growing up, you were in Tokyo at that time, right?
Yeah, I was in the equity division Stanley in Tokyo. I ran a division there.
But even though you were running a division, having to deal with other bankers and stuff, wasn't it kind of difficult, you being a foreigner?
Or
they give you automatic respect because of Morgan Stanley?
Morgan Stanley's name was...
You already got the name.
It's a credential
elevated.
You
good.
And Morgan Stanley in the equity division essentially had two very different business lines. One was selling Japanese equities and Japanese equity research to Japanese institutions and foreign investors. And there was a business of selling US-based research on US companies to Japanese investors who were making portfolio investments in the US. So prior to 1981, institutional investors really were not allowed by the government because of the foreign exchange controls to make portfolio investments. They could make seisaku toshi. So Sumitomo Life Insurance might buy into Firestone Rubber as sort of a passive investment, but not as a portfolio investment. So in 81, that was lifted. And that's when the trust banks managing pension funds, that's when, you know, insurance companies and so forth really started to aggressively invest overseas, which meant they needed research on U.S. companies. Morgan Stanley's analysts, you know, represented 80% of the S&P 500 as the top rated analyst. So it was a cushy job.
You had a
basically,
good job.
Basically taking, parroting what some guru on oil said and, you know, speaking to a Japanese institution and getting
support out of
that. So that wasn't an issue. And I folks talk about how Japan was a closed market and stuff. I don't think it was really closed. There were some reasons it was closed, but if you had an edge, and obviously Goldman, Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, a host of European firms were all very successful here.
Well, it didn't hurt to have somebody that actually understood the culture as well. That's what makes the biggest difference, because I've seen so many people come over in the same type of positions and get burned out real quick.
Yeah.
Because they're used to a faster pace, and there's one word that you need to learn and internalize. It's called gamma. If you don't have that here, you're not going to do business.
Yeah. No, it's fantastic. It was, you know, crazy times. I mean, you probably remember, if you wanted to take a taxi home, you had to, you know, how many times the fare?
Two, three times the fare. I love that. That's a good story. Because I'd be in Roppongi, Main Strip, and I'd found this out. And there would be a couple of people that were visiting something. No. They'd be in front of me going like this.
The cab
would pass them because I'm going like this.
Yeah.
And if they did that, if they knew to do this, I'd go like this, because they knew you knew. You're going to give three times whatever the fare ends up being.
Yeah, it was a bubble of epic proportions.
And, wasn't it?
And, you know, you buy stocks because they go up, and they go up because you buy them. And kau kara agaru, agaru kau. It was bizarre.
That's right.
What were some
of the most interesting things that happened to you during that time that you just sometimes sit back and think, I really was involved in this, or I really enjoyed this, or good things?
Well, obviously I was a lot younger, so the tolerance for that kind of, you know, bleep was a little bit more acceptable. But there's some very big differences, obviously. The commission rate, for example, was fixed. So if you were buying and selling Sony, Hitachi, IBM, these are fixed commissions, and there's a fixed tax. So the ability to earn substantial money on execution that doesn't exist today. Today you're doing it for basis points, but some brokers will execute your orders for free if you're a large institutional investor. So that was one thing. The other thing that's really bizarre, if you think about it, was insider information. Now, obviously, you got a cell phone somewhere. On your phone, you get anything, any kind of information instantly. And some, most of it, a lot of it's junk, but you can get factual information about a company, everybody at the same time. In the 80s, and insider information really wasn't illegal. It was how somebody from a big four Japanese brokerage firm could extract information from XYZ company that's going to sell more widgets, have an edge on that, and selectively provide that information to select institutions to curry favors for more orders, or if some stock went sour. People have heard about this, there are books written about it, but it was a bizarre situation when you think about the amount of compliance and regulatory oversight that's in every public market today.
Mm. So it's impossible for anything like that to happen now?
I can say impossible. I mean, there's
still a way.
There's still stuff that happens, but not blatant as it was back then.
Well, that wasn't only for Japan?
That was particularly, you talked about the bubble.
Here. That's right, that
and
was
the bubble
here.
was a narcotic. It was
in those days, if I wanted to, in those days, I could actually go into the bank, if I knew the bank you were in, and ask them what you had in it.
In my bank account.
In your bank account, and they would tell you.
Lance, my friend, how about just dropping your meishi when you went to dinner?
You know what I mean?
You'd go, it was common practice that if you go to a restaurant, high-end sushi shop, some Ginza bar, whatever, you could drop your company meishi.
And that would be
And they would send you the bill
That's right.
to the office, and we get paid.
That's right. That's right.
Bizarre.
No other place in the world would do that.
No.
No, not as big and as modern as this. No way. And that's something that's hard for people to understand. But I think the smaller, what do you think are some of the things that stop foreigners from wanting to be here? Because maybe I'm losing touch
wanting
with that.
Wanting to be here now or in those days?
In those days.
I can only speak to financial services.
Okay.
In financial services, generally what happened across most of the bulge bracket firms, and some have gone to a better place, Lehman and Bear Stearns, there are a whole bunch that are no longer there. But generally speaking, most US and European major banks started a presence in Japan. The office that was here first is Merrill Lynch. And Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley and those folks were there before, but it was a representative office. Merrill Lynch had individuals who catered to wealthy people, individuals in Japan, but not portfolio investments because as we spoke, it started in 81. But as the 80s progressed, and as Japan became a huge economic power, the stock market became important, it was a great place to make money for these firms. Typically what would happen is you'd go from rep to branch status. In Morgan Stanley's case, that was 84. And then you try to get a Tokyo Stock Exchange membership. In our case, it was 86, the British firms were earlier. So what happens is as you start growing these offices, you would select people from the head office who had experience in that area. So in other words, if it was a US Treasury trader, if it was a convertible bond guy, if it was a research guy, you kind of cherry-picked guys to populate the Tokyo offices. That's when it became an inverted pyramid. And the idea of a typical expat package is 5 years. So Lance Lee comes to Japan, you set up the trading, you find somebody from another brokerage firm, you recruit somebody, and in theory, you're replaced after 5 years to go back. So the call was not that hard to motivate talented young people to Japan, at least in my experience at Morgan Stanley. Usually that meant better pay, expat package, tax benefits, home leave, blah, blah,
Tell
blah.
Tell me what the package was.
Typical package?
Yes.
Typical package is, depending on your household, if you're single, if you're married, number of kids, depends on the number of bedrooms.
Okay, let's say a married person with a family of three kids.
Typically, those folks weren't sent.
Okay, I know they weren't.
Typically,
they
weren't.
When they were,
later on.
Right.
So the branch manager or the senior guy might be in that position.
Because
generally,
there
are people who are single or married or maybe on the way to have a kid. So it was, you know, a little bit
different. Right.
But you'd get a certain housing allowance. Typically, it would be a membership in a club like the Token American Club, a corporate membership. Mm-hmm. There would be what's called tax equalization, so that if you were hired in New York, and argument's sake, let's say your tax rate in New York is, just throw a number, 50%, mm-hmm. if you're living in New York, you're sent to Tokyo and the taxes are higher here, they would equalize that tax, so you're not paying any more than you would have been in New York. Typically, it would include, because of the hardship in Japan.
At that time, right.
It wasn't a hardship for most people.
And but, also
it, it, but some but, folks thought it was a hardship.
But also the size of apartments they got.
True.
Most Japanese still don't know.
No, true. Well, let me correct you on that, because at the same time that the foreign investment banks were coming to Japan in the mid to the late 80s, IBM also had a huge business here, so they had a lot of folks in the home ads. The home ads were developed for the
foreign
community.
They did that over one push, and they brought in 300 families.
Yeah,
I remember that.
Right.
But that really burned a lot of people.
It did. So there was a confluence of many folks trying to get through a small door, thinking that the room inside is a lot bigger. But the rooms, metaphorically speaking, were not that big. And today, like, you know, the apartments next door or this area, there are some beautiful apartments. So that was considered a bit of a hardship. But remember Tokyo, the skyline wasn't like this, Lance. The skyline, there were smaller buildings.
No, Tokyo Tower was the tallest thing we saw.
And that was in 58.
That's right.
And all of Nakadori, where my office is, the buildings are capped at 8-9 stories because you can look down the Imperial Palace now, of course, you know. So there were opportunities to rent houses here. I don't know if you remember, they used to have the house tours.
I remember that.
And there,
and
you know,
see all these beautiful, and you see
the Forest House in
Motoazabu.
I don't know if TAC organized it. Maybe TAC did.
Oh, did? Yes, TAC did organize it because I went to several.
You'd be able to go into these beautiful,
the beautiful gardens.
Gorgeous.
Oh, come on!
Of course, now that's all
with a Japanese home.
Yeah.
Sometimes, and you'd go, and they'd have the carp, and they'd have little bridges going. It was just
the last
beautiful.
Great one is just down the hill from Arisugawa Park. As you get down to Nishiazabu on the left-hand side, it's a wedding place now.
Okay.
It's fantastic. It was made in the Taisho period.
Wow.
It's beautiful.
Isn't it nice?
Beautiful.
Wow.
Really style.
Because I remember the transition. Do you know the transition of, okay, first, the first people here, of course, were traders. Then
Any
you
company.
Had, then after that, I think the banks started to come in. Your father and people like that. Because Bank of America.
52.
Okay.
Tokyo and
saying.
Kobe at the same time.
So I'm saying, then they came in, and you had a bunch of bankers trying
to sell.
You're
talking after the war, right?
Right, of course.
Okay.
Yeah, it has to be all after the war. That's what I'm talking about.
Because
that's what we would know most about.
Okay.
So then they came in. Then after that, I think after
shipping companies.
Then shipping.
Shipping was massive.
Okay, that became, but it still, it maintained itself. That didn't change so much.
Yeah, but you see, the exports are going so much that you wanted to anchor a ship to solidify a container that was leaving on a Tuesday or Thursday. You know what's really interesting to do for this? You go back through the Tokyo American Club magazine,
right?
And you see the sayonaras and the hellos, right? Of the people
that's
leaving
that's
and
right,
coming.
That's right.
That
would be
so neat.
And
if you look from, to your point, from the 50s, the records are there, 60s, 70s, 80s, of course, all investment bankers and stuff.
Right.
90s is there too.
But the 90s, you start to get into IT.
There's IT.
IT started becoming big,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, IT and...
And pharmaceuticals.
Pharmaceuticals.
Pharmaceuticals during that time, right. Because I remember...
It's an interesting mirror.
Right.
To see
Isn't it?
The foreign community, how it evolved. The sayonaras, of course,
right.
were the people in iBanks who were leaving because they're not getting the expat packages and all that was
right,
changing.
Right.
That becomes an interesting mirror. And today, it's a lot of tech, right? It's
a lot of tech and a lot of entrepreneurs, people that have their own businesses that come over here and say, I want to get a niche.
Yeah.
You don't see them coming in with the packages.
No.
That stopped a decade or more ago.
Yeah, the packages stopped.
No more packages. No. They say, if you want it, you're going to have to pay for it.
Yeah. And even at the leading investment banks, you're you know, taking off an expat, you go into a global program where you pay your own rent, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Rents are high here.
And one reason, I think, is because they started, first of all, when language became easier for everyone, when Japan stopped being that language that nobody could learn. You remember? Oh, if you know, if you said hi and you were saying hello to somebody, they went, "Sugoi desu ne." Yeah. Irai.
Jozu desu ne.
Jozu desu ne. Sugoi. Nihongo sugoi.
Yeah. And I but my vintage.
That's changed now. In Tokyo, at least.
Yeah.
Because you can still go outside and people still are amazed.
The vintage for me, when I started in financials, I was really one of the, if you might call it, pioneers, and it was because of my language and probably the yakety skill that I had. But today, go to 7-Eleven, go to Lawson. They speak really good Japanese.
And guess what?
Really good.
And no English.
Yeah, right.
They speak their native language and Japanese, but they do not know
Amazing.
English.
And I would have never
at the beginning,
that.
I said, "What? What? So Japanese is letting you know. Wait, hold it. They're coming to Japan.
Yeah."
And many of them cannot speak anything other than Japanese in their native language.
But I'm reading back to your point. So the guys showed up like my father after the war. 37 years here, Japanese.
You didn't need to.
You didn't need to.
And listen, and the Japanese were good. Even when I came here in the 70s, the early 70s. 大変でしょ、難しいから。 No, you'll never learn it.
Yeah.
Then, when Australians started in the 80s, putting in their schools,
okay.
And they came over here, and these little blonde-haired little girls would get up there, and guys would get up there, and blowing the Japanese away.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, it becomes easy.
There are some. I mean,
all of a sudden,
it
became
fluent.
Easy now.
Yeah. Like I said earlier, I don't take credit for that. I 100% to my mother, who spoke to me in Japanese, the housekeepers in Japanese, and I've studied French for 6 years. I can't order coffee, so it basically it's a mother tongue.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. You say, well, I got the hardest one. Here, how many French people can speak Japanese? Here's me. But how has that benefited you? Okay, tell me. You have the traditional image of what you think. I'm just saying, come on.
Let's go. Boy.
Come on now. And you're over here and you speak Japanese. Do you think that's really, really benefited you? Do you think that if someone
in
came
in the early
here,
years, no longer.
No longer?
In the first years, yeah. No, I mean, basically, I've been in the financial community for 44 years. I mean, people in that I deal with know who I am, so there's no surprise on one. But one of the more interesting stories, personal story, which I'll reveal, and why I think I had a reasonably good career at Morgan Stanley for the length I had and elevated in a very senior position despite my educational handicap, was in 82, 83, Morgan Stanley had a project with Mitsubishi Real Estate in Oregon. It's called the PacWest Center. And Mitsubishi Real Estate was building, you know, an office tower, shopping, that kind of thing. And it wasn't going well. And they needed to refinance. And they were pretty pissed. So I'm, you know, wearing a brown suit with shiny buttons. It could probably squeeze the milk out of my cheeks. And my boss calls me and goes, "Alcar, we want you to sit on this meeting. We've got the chairman, the president, everybody important for Mitsubishi Real Estate. It's a fill or kill." And Morgan Stanley's direction in Japan was to work with the Mitsubishi Group, Goldman largely with Sumitomo. They're all kind of different colors and texts, but we wanted to be really tight with the Mitsubishi for all the reasons. Look at where Morgan Stanley is with Mitsubishi today. And there's a guy called David Phillips who championed that. Long story short, so I'm called into this meeting. I know it's important. I know jack beep about real estate. But Alcar, you sit in on this meeting, don't say a word, and if you could pick up anything at all, let us know. But, you know, I'm 23, 24 years old, right? Brown suit, don't look like I know anything. There are 10 guys from Mitsubishi. It's the president of Morgan Stanley. I mean, every single senior guy, Dick Fisher. And it's this high-level meeting in the Exxon building in our dining rooms, and the meeting starts at 10 or something like that. And you can read people's faces. They were not happy on that side. And Morgan Stanley guys were worried that the deal would go somewhere else. Of course, typically there's a break after an hour, serve coffee, fire them up, right, put them out. And I'm standing by the window, just looking out the window, and these by the Japanese folks, Goldman Sachs, ne, 3.15 de yattu kure mitaina. Morgan no denwa takasugiru. Goldman, if we go to Goldman, they can do this. They'll outbid Morgan Stanley. They want this deal at PacWest Center. And I didn't know what that meant, but I knew that a competitor was going to come in at a better price. So I wrote on a paper napkin, I still have it in Kamakura, GS something or other, MS something or other. I can't remember exactly where, but they were a couple notches better than what we can offer. I pass this note around and our side lights up, Morgan Stanley. Because we are such, we really want to work with the Mitsubishi Group. You are our partners. We're going to go to the lowest rate, basically the conversation possible at 3.12. The smiles lit up on the other side because they didn't want to go somewhere else. Morgan Stanley got, so long story short, from that day on, for about 2 years, because I was the only guy who spoke Japanese in the head office,
you
I was called to every high level meeting with any Japanese that came to, I'm 24, 25 years old. And that was the only one that I had any relevance that would work, but because of that, I got to know all the senior people
and they knew you.
At Morgan Stanley, and they thought I was a cute kid who spoke Japanese. So I think that fostered sort of this, you know, relationship with the head office that most folks may not have had if it wasn't for the Japanese. So that's coming back to how did the Japanese help you?
That helps you a lot.
Otherwise,
that's,
not really.
That's good. That's
today,
good.
You know.
Do you read Japanese as well? Do you read it?
Well, when we finished Canadian Academy, which is the quote way equivalent of Nishimachi, in theory, one understands the Toyo Kanji, which is 1860, in theory. So you take French, Latin, or Japanese. Most kids took Japanese. So when I finished CA, there was a good understanding of kanji, but now it's Wapuro. And I have assistants that do the Japanese. If I read a newspaper, I don't understand it well enough that I can get the granular nuance, but then you can always put it on some G machine and it comes out. So.
Isn't that something too? Where do you think that's going to go? Because I can do that now. They have, what is it, Dark L or something like that.
Yeah,
Deep L. I think it's Deep L. Perfect translation.
Yeah.
And with that happening instantaneously, like the ticket I got the other day when I pulled up the policeman, he couldn't speak any English whatsoever. And I'm, of course, not going to say anything to him in Japanese. And he said, okay, Masuka, and I went, and he said, do you understand? And he was listen. Oh, yeah, yeah. And said, you didn't stop at a stop sign. And I said,
oh, dear.
Okay. And he says, okay, you're going to get a ticket.
Oh, dear.
And I
good
said,
old
really?
Days, Lance. How about the good old days?
Wakarimasen. So we're gonna, you don't have to say, no, you say, excuse me, I don't understand. You have to really.
Oh, dear.
And they just say, ja, be careful.
Yeah.
And that was it.
Well, you could get away with so much. I mean,
so you're going to, do you see yourself being here indefinitely in Japan? You don't want to say that.
Well, the short answer is I'm applying for permanent residency. I have a home in Hawaii, a home in San Francisco. We kind of washed out. I can't live in America, quite frankly. Hawaii's
why,
a great
why,
place.
Why can't you live in America?
People are too selfish. It's a me society.
Me society?
And for me.
Yeah. Well, you grew up here.
For me, it's a little
bit. Your emotional, they say emotions are built by the age of 12. And everything else is just information. So mostly you were set up in a culture of ware-ware. But still you had.
I like kindness. I like the selflessness. How about, January 1? I mean, any other place in the world that pain would have perished. Okay, it's the selflessness. It's the genuine kindness of the Japanese. The co-CEO of my company was here in December. And literally he dropped a 10,000 yen note as we went in the Peninsula Hotel. The cab driver runs up and gives it to him. There's no
Where
country
else?
Like this. It's clean. It's immaculate. I like cleanliness. You see,
Let me ask you this. Do you think the Japanese feel the same way?
If you were
Japanese.
No, I'm spoiled. Are you kidding?
Okay.
I'm privileged to the max. Lance.
Would you want to stay here if you were Japanese, do you think?
I can't answer that.
Of course you can't.
I really can't, and I don't even want to get my head around it.
But you don't want to get your head around it.
But I'll be blunt. I am probably one of the most privileged people on the planet. I mean, having the background that I have, my family history here. At one time, our family name is probably one of the best known foreign names in Japan, and it was the chocolate business.
What I like about you, John, because you've always been so Japanese in respect that you never want to be in Meidatsu, because you already are.
No, I don't need it.
I know you don't have to be, because you already are, and you know that. But still, you don't carry that air around. Because some people do. You know, some people, you see them here, and I'm sure you see them, and it pisses you off because you can see it. And it doesn't matter what their ethnicity is. All they have to be is not Japanese. And you can see it. They've come to a place where they know they have it better than where they came from.
I also there's a bit of age involved as well. As you get older, you do want a little bit more cleanliness, orderliness, a polite society, not where people are bifurcated. Are you CNN or are you Fox? And you know, come on, man.
Are they telling you the truth? Or are they trying to get you to belong to some sort of cult?
And it's a very sad state, particularly San Francisco, beloved San Francisco, where my sons are and where a lot of my family members are. It's just gone into decay, moral, and it's decay in the city. It was one of the most beautiful cities in the world.
It used to be.
I'm a 60s.
Well, they still
guy,
have the infrastructure, but they'd need somebody like a Giuliani or something to come in there. If they did that, but see, it can't happen on the West Coast.
No, but everyone's got
if
their
the West
own
Coast, I can see where that would go.
So, as far as I'm concerned, this is just a wonderful environment to be in. Japan. There are many places that off the beaten track that are just stunning.
Well, you had a great time over the COVID time. You and your buddies went all over Japan and had a great time. I saw the three albums.
Yeah, COVID, you know, was obviously bizarre for many people and hardships, undue hardships on many, many people. But I, to be blunt, I really milked it. And I traveled all over Japan. I stayed in places that are normally very expensive for a very reasonable amount of money. I'm a bit of a prankster, so, you know, I take my sake and a pet bottle of, you know, Evian or something, and I'll have another water, but, you know, I have my sake here and there with the restaurants weren't serving. But
you guys had a good time.
We had a great time.
That's wonderful too. And then Paul with his license, so you guys took the boat around the coast and had a good time.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah,
so where do you see Japan going? Let's end by asking you a few questions, the last question about where do you see Japan going over the next 5, 10 years?
Well, if you believe that things like the stock market or the currency reflect a lot of people's opinions, it's telling you that given where the stock market has gone the last 10 years and the last 6 months, where the yen has gone the last couple of years, that this place is happening. There is obviously all kinds of concerns about China for all the reasons that we know that there are a lot of high-end chip makers who are putting up plants in Kyushu. Japan's having another sort of economic boom after being sort of, you know, nowhere for 20 or 30 years. I don't say nowhere because lots have happened in Japan the last 20, 30 years, okay? But that's the headlines. But as I see it, if you look at where I'm a finance guy, if you look at financial markets, they're telling you that, you know, things are very different this time than maybe they have been before. The input cost, because Japan imports everything, is really, it's like a snake that swallowed a rat or a frog. It takes a long time for those import costs to get fully into the system. There's still, in my opinion, there's probably going to be some inflationary pressures here. Things are going to get more expensive. Airline tickets are crazy. So I don't know if I answered your question right, but
you see Japan on the upswing.
Yeah, and I.
You think it's going to do well?
Yeah.
I feel that way too. I'm optimistic. But there's no place I'd rather be on this planet of a big city if there was a natural or interstellar event that happened. There's no other place I'd rather be, because it's not the event that would bother me so much. It's how people act afterwards.
Yeah, I'm with you.
And here, they have centuries of knowing how to say, my house is on fire because the volcano and stuff, a shogunai, and let's just rebuild and get on with it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, you know, the country has a long history of tolerance, from typhoons to earthquakes and all that kind
everything.
Of stuff.
Everything. Well, question I like to ask everyone at the end of my podcast. I hope you know what it is.
I do.
All right. If you could go back in time and meet Jumpin' Jack John, or you pick the time, knowing what you know today, what advice would you give him? Or would you give him any advice?
I would give this advice to me and anybody else. I would try to be better at inside looking out than outside looking in. And by that I mean, outside looking is when you let stuff that you can't control affect your mood and life. it's a storm, it rains, things that you can't control, or the BS on the headlines and the news and stuff that you see obviously bothers a lot of people. People are worried about AI. There's a lot of worry in the world about the election. There's a lot of worry about the wars and stuff. And these kind of things are pressures that one reflects as the outside looking in. Philosophically, I want to be a better Buddha self. Philosophically, I want to be a kinder, better, more compassionate person to my fellow man, do one kind deed to somebody unknown every day, but be better at inside looking out. You know what I'm saying?
I hear
Make
you.
Sense?
That makes sense. Yeah. Thank you so much, John. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I want to thank all of you for watching this podcast or listening to it. And remember, it's all on loan, so continue to reach for the star.
Because you're too blessed to be stressed.